Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And of course, Zorba, along with our call, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about society and doctors and weight. Turns out that many doctors do not discuss weight gain in children and what does that mean for our society. If a child comes in and they're overweight, they don't even discuss it. Mm-hmm. What shall we do about it?
And?
Food, mislabeled food, finding their way to restaurants and dinner tables. Big issue that what you get may not be what you think you are getting.
What's our recipe?
Mediterranean lamb medley. It is a delicious recipe, especially if you happen to love lamb. I love lamb. If you love lamb like I love lamb, stay tuned because this is your time to shine.
Sounds pretty fancy. Can't wait to hear it. To the phones now, Zorba, though, and a listener with us in Brennan, Texas. Hi.
Hi, hello.
How can we help?
Well, I'm a musician. I've been touring with major acts since I was 18, and I'm 62 right now. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed in the last year, there's been a numbness on the front of my feet, by my toes, mm-hmm. and on both feet. And I don't know if it's from years and years of traveling or on stage or what it could be. Other than that, I'm in fairly good health.
Yeah. What instrument do you play?
I play guitar.
Uh-huh. Well, lucky you don't play the drums, I guess, if your feet don't work well.
Yeah, I guess so. It just flared up this year, and I kind of felt it coming because in the last couple of years I've noticed how sensitive my feet were, like if I walk barefoot on the grass or on or on gravel, that it kind of hurt.
And then a couple of questions because
sure.
Peripheral neuropathy, which is the peripheral means periphery, the part of the body that's the farthest away, which are feet. Neuropathy means an abnormal nerve. So peripheral neuropathy is a problem that can occur with a number of diseases. If you go to the net, you'll see a list that's really, really long, more than one screen long with this. So a couple of questions about this. And by the way, a part of peripheral neuropathy can be numbness, can be tingling. It can be you don't feel the sensation in your toe, or then sensations are there that you don't like. Something called allodynia, A-L-L-O-Y-D-A-N-I-A. Allodynia means something that's an abnormally painful sensation that should normally be neutral, like a cover on your foot and so on. So we want to look at causes. Do you have alcohol? Any alcoholism? Did you drink a lot?
I drink wine, which is kind of like a...
Yeah, but how about 20 years ago? Musician?
Oh, no. Yeah. 20 years ago, I actually didn't drink wine.
Okay, so alcohol is a major thing with peripheral neuropathy. Diabetes.
Oh, wow.
Do you have diabetes? Have you been checked for diabetes?
No, I don't.
Have you been checked for it?
I've been checked for it, yes.
Okay.
I don't have it.
Common thing with diabetes. B12 deficiency is another thing that pops up. B12 and folate are two things we check. And if you haven't been checked for a B12 deficiency, I would definitely get checked. Because that can produce that. And then if you globally look at this, peripheral neuropathy, about 25 to 30% is what we call idiopathic, which means we don't know why it actually occurs. It's idiopathic. So what I would recommend doing is go to the web, write down peripheral neuropathy, look at the list of things on there, go to your doctor, check off, check, make sure that none of those things are medical problems you suffer from. Then on the other side, you say, okay, it's idiopathic, don't know what causes it. You want to look at treatment for this. Mm-hmm. Now, have you been on gabapentin, which is an anti-epileptic drug that works well for this?
No, I haven't.
I would consider gabapentin. It's now a prescription drug that is a generic, cheaper than it used to be. You get it from your doctor. Name brand was Neurontin, N-E-U-R-O-N-T-I-N. It's now in a generic. And I would consider taking that. Some people take that at bedtime, 300 milligrams. It works well. Some people take it at bedtime during the daytime. And if it really bothers you, I would consider just treating it after you rule out major medical problems.
With shooting pain, you know, I do experience a little bit of like a shooting little like electric pains down there too. You know,
electric is usually synonymous with a peripheral neuropathy. They usually feel like electric. That's the way we describe it. Now, I have a question. Have you ever been electrocuted, like put your finger in a socket or anything like that?
No, I think maybe once or twice.
I mean, I remember I did it once. You know, when I was younger, I was trying to get toast out of a toaster. I was 8 or 9. I remember it was just awful. It was a buzz. But it's interesting that people call it electric when, in fact, most people have never gotten shocked and actually felt that electricity. Yeah. And we sort of know what it is. So it must be from these micro shocks from things such as static electricity. So good luck. Gabapentin.
You say you toured. Mm-hmm. Did you tour with any band we would know?
Well, yes. I've toured with people like, names like Ricky Nelson, Chris Christopherson,
ooh,
Dolly Parton.
Ooh.
You know, people like that, yeah.
Uh-huh. You're good.
Yeah. Well, I've been around for a long time, you know, and this is just something that just flared up, and I was concerned because I'm still touring. I'm getting ready to go to Norway next month, so it's been getting a little bit worse with these little electric pains, you know, and I didn't know whether they're related to wearing boots or
probably not. If your feet are good, you're not getting blisters. It's probably not that. Tour away, get the gabapentin, and by the way, if you take it at bedtime, it helps you sleep.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for the call.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And a listener in Zorba in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, first I want to tell Zorba that the thing I appreciate most about you is that you actually listen to patients instead of just asking about lab results, because that seems to be the way things are done now. But that's another topic.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Very kind.
Here's the problem. I'm 61, and I usually don't feel my age except in the winter because my legs and feet are cold all the time. I've been to an endocrinologist. I've been hypothyroid for a long time and been taking Synthroid. And my internist, you know, does the blood work every 4 to 6 months to make sure I'm at the right level. But still, I wanted to go to an endocrinologist. And she, last winter, increased my Synthroid from 100 to 112 micrograms, is it? And it helped a little, but it increased my appetite a lot, so I didn't want to do that. But no matter how many layers I'm wearing on my legs and feet, I'm still cold.
Sure,
and
sure.
I also have restless leg syndrome. I don't know if that's related or not.
Yeah, probably not. But first of all, from Synthroid, which is synthetic thyroid, from that point of view, we give the medication, we measure a certain measurement in the blood, something called TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, and then we regulate it based on that. It should be within a certain range, not too low, not too high, done. Basically, and for 95% of the people, it's a very simple issue. One of the things I would look at is I would look at your meds with a list. I would talk to your local pharmacist where you get your meds and say, can any of these cause cold feet? And the reason is it's a common side effect of cold limbs, numbness, or tingling in the limbs with certain drugs. So I'd rule those out. I'd want to make sure with every drug there isn't anything there. And a pharmacist, if they do it, can easily give you that information. They can do a med search and they can find out what that's at. Failing that, how old are you? Are you over 39?
61.
Oh, 61.
61.
Somebody was listening.
Yes.
and he wasn't a doctor.
Yeah.
One for Tom, none for Zorba. That's right. One for Tom, none for Zorba. My point is, it is an issue that also occurs as we get older. That cold somehow bothers us more. We have to dress in more layers. And when we're younger, we're not as bothered by it. And I'm not exactly sure why that is.
Well, why is it just my legs? And it's just, you know, below the knee. My upper body is fine. You know, when I have the thermostat up so that I'm comfortable from the knees up, That's fine, but my legs and feet are still cold. Is it circulation?
Well, it's not that you have bad circulation. So people wonder right away, and they'll come into my office, and they'll say, is it a circulatory problem? And I'll check their pulses, and their pulses are fine. So it's not arterial circulation. We don't have a good answer for this. There's no good answer. So what it means is that you have to wear warmer socks. Smart wool socks are a perfect example, or double layer, which will often do it, because you treat basically the problem that's there. But I don't think anyone has ever given me a good explanation scientifically as to why people get, quote, cold feet.
Will exercising more help? I'm not a big exerciser.
I think you can try exercise to see if it will make a difference. And that's basically how we treat peripheral, you know, this peripheral coldness that people had. But I will tell you, you are not alone. It is a common problem that people talk about.
Oh, boy. Yep. Okay.
The best answer. Thank you
all
so much.
Thanks.
We appreciate the call. Thank you.
You know, one of the issues that is very disconcerting for all of us is we like to have a cause and effect. So we like to have, okay, I've got cold feet. Why do I have it? Oh, you have it from diabetes. If you get your diabetes into proper alignment, you may get better. And now, even when you get better, you may still have that peripheral problem with your feet, but you know that it's caused by your diabetes, and that's comforting.
Yeah.
When you don't know what causes something.
Yeah, you don't know what the fix is. If you don't know what the cause, you don't know what the fix is.
That's discomforting.
Yeah. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. Before our next call, though, Zorba, interesting topic to talk about. Doctors and kids who are obese. What do doctors say to the parents of these kids? What do doctors do? What should they say?
Well, this is a problematic issue. When we look at our kids, 33% of the children in America today are overweight. And 17% of the children in America today, literally almost one out of five, are obese by definition. And when we see children in our office initially for the first two or three years, we put them on a growth curve and we want them to grow and gain weight. It's very important for childhood development. But after they get to a certain weight and they're fine, let's say they're five or six, we don't tend to look at obesity and give good direction to parents. And I think it's this pound creep, this kilogram creep that has been very, very difficult to get a handle on.
Is this a study that...
This is a particular study that looks at the fact that parents tend to realize when there's a weight problem, when they're told about it by their physicians, many, many parents will begin to take action. But most parents are not told about that weight problem in their office. They may have been given a little statement where your child fits and they're overweight, but they're not actually given counseling on that. And 30% of the parents of overweight kids said if a doctor alerted them, that's what the study, they would take action. And the issue is even physicians are lax about this.
I can kind of understand it. I bring my kid in to the doctor because the kid has a cold or a fever or something. The doctor tends to deal with the cold and fever and maybe is a little reluctant to say, by the way, your kid is really overweight.
Well,
it's not why the parent brought the kid in.
Exactly. There's a problem issue with that, and there's a problem issue with, okay, your child is overweight, and you're telling a mother maybe who's in there, and she's overweight. You know, and so there's kind of a social thing, like, are you insulting the mother? And I'll give you a good example. In my office, I had a woman in my office, and her son was morbidly overweight. He was over 200 pounds. Yeah. And I talked to her about it, and she said, I don't think he's that bad. Well, she was 300 pounds.
Yeah.
And so she was morbidly obese, and he really, for his age, was morbidly obese, and it produced a very robust discussion.
Yeah. You say it could happen that would help deal with the problem.
Absolutely.
The study showed alerting
makes a difference.
It also could happen that the parent says, hey, I didn't bring my kid in for that. I brought my kid in to take care of this. Mind your own business.
Right, right. Well, patients tend not to do that. They don't say mind your own business. They don't actually say that. that's kind of insulting. And you almost never had that experience. And if you do, there's something else going on.
Yeah.
But the reality is they may be thinking that and they won't say that. And I think that's part of what's going on. It's, I want to bring this up. And basically they came in for something else. So I think you're right on with that. And I think a lot of patients don't suggest that, but I think a lot of doctors don't talk about obesity.
1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener now in Joplin, Missouri. Hi.
Hello guys. I appreciate the show. I have an interesting topic here. In 1980, I had a stroke. I'm a 42-year-old man now, In 1980, I had a stroke, a cerebral infarction, where I lost my peripheral vision on both sides. And went to Mayo Clinic. I mean, my parents, of course, went into action. I went to all kinds of doctors, all kinds of tests. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, I had angiograms, CAT scans, the whole nine yards. There just wasn't a whole lot there for adolescent strokes for them to kind of go on. So they just kind of chalked it off as, okay, he had a stroke, and I was an oddity for a while in the medical field. But as I and now that I'm 42, I have noticed, and I'm looking back now, is I've suffered from depression since I can remember. And I've been trying to do some research on finding if there's a correlation between strokes and depression. I know there is in adults. Of course, if you lose a stroke, you can lose one side of your body or, you know, anything else, which can cause an emotional depression. But I'm wondering if having a stroke can change the chemicals in the brain, serotonins and the dopamines, that can actually make depression more prevalent in stroke victims.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, as you said, in adults, stroke and depression often go hand in hand. Depression does not cause stroke at all. But people who have strokes often have depression. And it's not just a situational depression that they have a stroke and they're depressed because they may lose some function. It appears to be one of the things that can occur. And we don't have a depression center in the brain. In other words, there's no one has found yet any part of the brain that when this has a stroke, you're depressed, and when this does not have a stroke, you're not depressed. We don't really know even where consciousness is.
How about the specific question? Does it affect our serotonin or dopamine?
Well, the answer is we don't really know that. We don't know where depression is in the brain. We don't know how it's related. We know that when we give serotonin reuptake inhibitors, antidepressants called SSRIs, that people get better. But this is sort of globally produced within the brain. And so, and certainly with adolescents, because we don't understand adolescent stroke because it's so rare, so uncommon, yeah. You know, that could easily follow with adult stroke and make a difference for that. But I do want to talk a bit about depression in adolescents. That's not uncommon. In other words, adolescents often have depression. It might be 5%, it might be 10% on who you believe. And adults have depression. 1 out of 20 adults suffers from depression, significant depression at some time in their life. So these are common problems. So I think the bottom line is, I don't know if your depression was caused by your stroke, mm-hmm. or if these were just two different problems that were going on simultaneously. I don't think anyone really know that.
Yeah, are you getting good treatment for your depression?
I am. As I've gotten older, I've done more research. I have gotten better with it. I started adding things up. And I thought, this is interesting, because I remember having depression and panic attacks also right after the stroke. And I say right after, you know, a year after I developed this.
Right. So it seemed, and on one level, you would say, well, there's kind of a cause here and you have an effect.
Right.
The cause is you had the stroke and then all of a sudden you had panic attacks and depression. On the other hand, there are 11 and 12 and 13-year-olds who develop panic attacks and depression and never have a stroke. You know, they've never had one. Do you have depression in your family at all?
Yeah, I do have a family history of it. Yes.
So a family history of depression just tends to, to say this may be just be running in your family. I would say getting treatment is the most important thing, and that we don't have enough research in adolescent stroke to give the answer. But it sounds like you had a risk factor, maybe of the stroke. We know in adults it is, and of course the family issue. Thanks for your call. Thanks for bringing this up. This is it's a very unusual thing to get a call from somebody who's an adolescent who had stroke. So thank you.
Not a problem. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
We appreciate that call. And before the break, Zorba, let's sort through another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. On a recent show, we were helping a listener who was traveling to Machu Picchu, as you may or may not recall. The question concerned chewing cocoa leaves to combat altitude sickness.
Yes, yes, I remember that.
Well, a listener named Anthony wrote in to correct an issue with your advice, and in doing so, may have officially created another branch of Zorba Pasture on Your Health enforcement. Anthony writes, "You made the comment that the Mayan traditionally chewed coca leaves. I have to beg to differ with you. I would argue that it was, is, the Inca and their
right.
ancestors
right.
who
right.
inhabited
That's
the
right.
area in which Machu Picchu right. is located.
Right.
That's Peru, and who used coca leaves. The Mayan culture was centered in what is now southern Mexico
right.
and northern Central America. The newly formed geography police are letting you off with a warning. I really appreciate your show.
You know, it's a whole problem. Mayans, Incans, Incas and Aztecs, I get confused. Stand corrected. The geography police have definitely given me a warning. I will make sure I do not get a ticket next time.
If Zorba's advice or world history is a little off or in the wrong hemisphere, let us know. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a really good recipe coming up. More of your calls coming up, too. And, of course, our medical myth-buster a little later. Good to have you with us. And we hope you'll stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Listeners waiting, but room for you at 1-800-462-7413. Before our next call, Zorba, our recipe, and it sounds like a yummy one to me, Mediterranean lamb medley.
Yes, yes. Do you like lamb?
I do.
I like lamb a lot.
And I like Mediterranean cooking,
and
too.
Mediterranean cooking is just delicious.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, variety of food. The Mediterranean diet, of course, is really a great way to think of food.
And usually nicely spiced.
Nicely spiced. Yeah. That's right. Now, of course, the only place that you want to eat something like this is perhaps on Crete. You might want to be in the south of France, you know, maybe the Adriatic Sea. I mean, I think we have to go to the Mediterranean Sea in order to
enjoy. I spent about a month on the island of Crete.
You did, on the island. What were you doing on
the
island?
It was way back then.
Island of Crete.
In the USN.
Uh-huh.
And,
in the USN.
Yeah.
On the island of Crete. Did they have a, they had a, some sort of a place on the, or was
no,
this R&R?
Our LST went charging up on the beach and opened the bomb door. And we hung around. Don't ask me what we were doing. I was just a, you know, a grunt, so I didn't.
You were just a young man all of a sudden on the isle of
Let's
Crete
do the recipe.
In the Mediterranean
Sea.
I think there's more to this story time than just Mediterranean lamb melody.
Okay.
Okay. Let's talk about our spices. Start out with
I love
teaspoons.
The melody thing, by the way. Mediterranean lamb is our recipe.
That's right. We'll call it a melody instead of a medley.
Right. Okay.
Start out with 2 teaspoons of coriander seeds.
2 little tea. Coriander seeds.
2 teaspoons of fennel seeds.
2 little tea. Fennel seeds.
2 tablespoonfuls of thyme. Fresh thyme.
2 big tea, fresh thyme.
1/4 teaspoon of whole black pepper.
1/4 little tea, whole black pepper.
1 teaspoon of kosher salt.
Little tea, kosher salt.
1 clove of garlic.
A clove of garlic.
1 teaspoon of olive oil.
Little tea, olive oil.
Okay. Now you're going to get 4 lamb chops well trimmed.
4 lamb chops well trimmed.
That's right. Now, for the vegetables, a large red onion that has been coarsely chopped.
Mm-hmm. Large red onion, coarsely chopped.
2 medium zucchinis that are sliced.
2 medium zucchinis sliced.
2 yellow crook-neck squash. You know that yellow, those yellow squash that kind of have a funny neck.
Yeah, I know exactly.
Or regular yellow squash.
Yeah, they don't taste that good. But
Some of us like yellow squash.
Do we chop them up?
Yes, we're going to slice them.
Okay.
Slice them. Yeah, no, we're going to put it whole. Just put it whole. That's right. That's right. When do you not slice a squash?
Right.
Well, when you stuff a squash, you don't. Let's go into that. A tablespoonful of fresh thyme, again, diced up.
1 big tea, more fresh thyme.
That's right. 2 tablespoonfuls of balsamic vinegar.
2 big tea, balsamic vinegar.
And 1 teaspoon of olive oil.
Little tea, olive oil.
Okay, so preheat the oven to 425 degrees. Now, On the lamb, combine the spices, coriander, fennel, thyme, and whole black peppercorns in a grinder or blender, coarsely grind it, and then transfer the spice rub to a small little bowl. Then fold in the salt, you know, put the salt in there. Then rub the garlic and oil all over the lamb chop. So you're taking that clove, rubbing the garlic with a little bit of oil over the lamb chop. Then you rub the spice mixture over it, and then transfer the chops to a baking sheet. Let it sit for an hour. Just let that marinade get into the lamb. Now for the veggies. While the lamb is marinating, place the sliced vegetables in a greased baking sheet. Sprinkle the fresh thyme over the vegetables and then drizzle the vinegar and the oil over the medley and carefully kind of shake it to make sure it's all kind of coated. Then roast the lamb and veggies together. Together for 25 to 30 minutes. You're going to flip it once during that time, then let it sit for 10 minutes with a little, tent it with a little aluminum foil so that it really gets into the lamb, all the spices. It's wonderful.
Well, couldn't I, like, substitute, I don't know, something for the squash?
Yes, you could. Yes, you could.
Cauliflower.
Cauliflower. That'd be okay. That would be okay. Yeah. Cauliflower and broccoli. The squash is going to pick up the spice, but yeah, cauliflower and broccoli, you could actually substitute. I would do something that's going to do well in the oven, but squash. Yeah, you could do it. How about zucchini?
Yeah,
zucchini.
That'd be all right. Yeah.
Zucchini would be okay for you. Now, the calories, 252 calories. There's some calories from fat. About 100 calories, roughly, are going to come from fat. But it's really a delicious, wonderful recipe that you're going to want to try.
You'll How am I going to find out about that recipe?
You know, I know you'll be absolutely shocked. I know you'll be shocked for this. But if you come to our website at zorbapastor.org, if you come to that website, you can get this recipe. You can go to our archives and find lots of other recipes. You can sign up for our weekly podcast, and we podcast this entire show now at our website, that's zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
one 800 462 7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, here's a listener in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, thank you guys for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
Basically, I've been a sick kid my entire life, and then when I was about 25, 26, they found out that I was allergic to everything, including several foods. So I basically went from eating really healthy to eating hamburgers and cheese pizza and soda every day,
and that's all
I would eat.
Goodness, what foods did you find out you were allergic to?
I'm allergic to soy, which is in pretty much everything, it seems like. I'm allergic to nuts, and I was having oral allergy syndrome with most fruits and vegetables.
I've got to question you about this. There are people who have multiple allergies, and then there are things that occur randomly. So let's go over things like the nuts. You take a nut, what kind of nuts, and what happens to you?
Basically, what would happen with me is I would eat an almond, let's say, and I would just feel really nauseous, and I would feel bad, like I had the flu for a couple hours, and then I would feel fine.
Now, did you retry that again? In other words,
I haven't retried anything.
Okay.
And,
so let me go. I want to go into that part. That's why this is so important. I want to give you a perfect example. For many, many years, I've done research on new medications that came out. Zithromax, which is a commonly used antibiotic, we did research on years ago as an example. So when people come in, let's say they're getting an experimental drug under FDA guidelines, they come in, they get the medication, and we want to know if they have a rash. Okay, they might be on a high blood pressure pill, and rashes are really important. So they'll come in, let's say, they're on a high blood pressure pill, they'll get a rash. I then have to evaluate if I think it's a true allergic reaction, and many of those have hives and they're itchy, or I have to decide, is this just a rash that occurred concurrently at the same time? So roughly half the time or two-thirds of the time, there are no hives, I think it's safe, and we'll re-challenge the patient with that drug. Might be a placebo, by the way. Half the time it's a placebo. We'll re-challenge them. I would guess in the work that I do, 90% of the time, the second time, they don't get the rash. 90%, huge dose. And then when we break the code, we find out that about 30% of the rashes were placebo rashes. In other words, they were not related to the drug, and they weren't related to the placebo. In other words, they just came at the same time. So I caution you, because with food intolerance, if people eat something only once or twice and they go, I'm intolerant, sometimes they just were, there's something else was going on in their life, physically going on, and then you correspond that to the food. So if you've narrowed your food choices, I can't eat many nuts, I can't eat eat many fruits. I can't eat many vegetables. That's the time that I look and I say, you've got to be rechallenged and see if this is a true intolerance. And I would bet that you're not intolerant to all those things you think you're intolerant to. You may be intolerant to some, but I would venture to guess it's not all.
Okay. And that's kind of my question, because I'm tired of eating like this.
Absolutely.
So I've started to try to eat things again, and what will happen is I'll feel really sick. I'll get really sweaty right away, and I'll kind of have that flu-like feeling, and then an hour later I'll be better. So I went to the allergist again yesterday and said, it doesn't seem like it's allergies because we've tested this food and it says there's nothing there. And he thought it was hypoglycemia happening right away.
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, it could be hypoglycemia. You've got to look for other things. That would be a good example. There also are people who get gustatory sweating, where as they eat, they actually physically sweat. Their face may sweat. They may have a little bloating. They may feel a little bit nauseous. There are medications that are useful for that, and that may be what you have. You may have a variant of gustatory sweating, so it's not related to the food, but it's related to how you eat. Sometimes it's related to the spice. Look up gustatory sweating on the net. We'll put it on our website, zorbapastor.org, so our other listeners can link to it. And that may be what you have. Doesn't sound to me like this is a true food allergy. I think you've got to look at those things. And you may want to go to your internist, family doc, or endocrinologist to look at gustatory sweating and what you can do about that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Good luck to you. Can she have a hamburger every now and then?
Of course, but not every day, Tom. Now, you know what? You, Tom, would love to have gustatory sweating with everything but a cheeseburger, because then you could have a cheeseburger for breakfast, cheeseburger for lunch, and a cheeseburger for dinner.
Not quite that bad. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And before we take a short break, Zorba, let's play another round of Stump the Doc. We have an overseas contestant today, compliments of her translator, Erin, from Wisconsin. I'll let Erin explain. She writes, I am a Wisconsinite who lives in France, and I would like to ask a question on behalf of a French friend who does not speak English. She is a 56-year-old woman who has no weight issues. She recently had a physical during which she was told that her cholesterol numbers were not ideal. The nurse reading her results said that some dietary changes were needed, one of which was to not have meat and cheese at the same meal. I had never heard this advice before. The obvious dietary French penchant is for cheese. Can you shed some light on this advice?
Yeah, I think it's garbage. I think it's junk. Who said you can't have cheese and meat at the same meal? Obviously someone, but it doesn't make any sense to me.
Let me suggest a possible reason.
Yeah, okay, please.
You all often say that European meals are smaller, the portions are smaller than American portions.
They are.
I mean, it could just be that if you're used to a regular portion of meat and a regular portion of cheese, that eating the two of them together would not be ideal if you're worried about a cholesterol.
Well, that certainly is a good, I mean, that's a good explanation as to why you would say that. But what's going to happen is she can't eat cheeseburgers. What's life without cheeseburgers?
Well, she's in France. What is she?
Yeah, that's right. They go for Mickey D's too. But in all seriousness, there's no reason why you could not have cheese and meat at the same meal. When you're looking at a quantity issue, that really becomes the issue. Now, maybe she was keeping kosher. And you can't have cheese and meat at the same meal. So she should go back and ask her friend, was the nurse an Orthodox Jew who said she shouldn't have cheese and meat at the meal, in which case it was a religious dictum.
Yeah, being substituted for health advice.
That's right. There you go. That's it, Tom. You got it.
Health advice being substituted for religion.
You got it.
Anyway, Zorba's advice translates in any language. Just send your lifestyle questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Another interesting topic to talk over, more of your calls and our medical myth buster. You don't want to go away. You stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413, and we will return to the phones. After Zorba, we talk about food mislabeling, how we can get duped at the grocery store.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, this is a very interesting article in the New York Times. I've been reading it, and I was kind of floored. And guy walked into a restaurant, ordered catfish, and was served tilapia. And if I've tasted catfish, and I've tasted tilapia. I'm going to like it. I like both of them. They taste completely different. And he said to the restaurant owner, wait a minute, I ordered catfish. You fried the wrong fish. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. We ran out of catfish. So it was bait and switch.
I said, at the store, does this happen in grocery stores or just
Well, it may happen in grocery stores, too. It turns out that when they did some research, they found out in every one of the 16 sushi bars in New York that they investigated, researchers found mislabeled fish. In other words, it was 100%. In other words, they tested the fish by DNA testing, and some of the fish wasn't the fish. Something called tilefish was posing as red snapper. It's a different fish. Farm salmon was sold as wild salmon. Escalar, which has been called oil fish, was then sold as white tuna. Yeah. And so the answer is this may be also happening in the grocery store, and it can be a big issue, especially because you're paying more money for expensive fish.
Yeah, but maybe it isn't such a big issue.
Yeah.
Can you taste the difference between the real thing and whatever they substitute
Well, first of all, I can taste the difference between tilapia and catfish. That's a very obvious difference.
Then when you're served it, you can say, wait a minute, this isn't the right fish.
Well, but
Have you ever said that?
No, I've never said that.
Well,
I don't do that.
So maybe you can't tell the difference.
Well, first of all, I mean, when I get catfish, I've had catfish as far as I remember, as every single time I've had catfish. Yeah. But, I mean, some people don't say anything about it, and they'll say, this catfish tastes a little bit different, and they'll walk out of the restaurant. I mean, if I order fish, I want it to be that fish. It just is unethical to be served something else. But you're right. You're smiling because you can't tell the difference.
If you really can't tell the difference, then
you're paying more money for, like, farm wild salmon. You're paying more money than farm salmon, right?
Yeah.
So if you're paying a premium, you should get that product for whatever reason, often ecological reasons that you want to have it or you don't want chemicals.
I agree there's an ethical violation here, but yes, but maybe maybe it yeah. isn't really a significant
You mean a significant ethical violation? No, ethically it is a violation. You mean maybe it's not a taste violation. Maybe we can't. You know something? You mean I should give up my snooty ways of wanting to have what I order in a restaurant and just take what I'm given?
If I ever run a restaurant, I want to be able to dupe you in any way I possibly can.
Well, when you go into a restaurant, if the fish tastes funny to you, make sure you send it back and tell them, are you sure this is what I ordered? Because it might not be that.
800-462-7413, and a listener with us now, Zorba, in Paradise Valley, Montana. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, my question regards my 21-year-old daughter. She has had epilepsy and seizures since she was about 9 years old. Mm. She's been treated by several physicians and with several different medications over this period of time. Mm-hmm. She still has breakthrough seizures. She still has petite mal seizures frequently, loses motor control, sometimes spills stuff, trips. Her current physician thinks she needs to see a specialist in the realm of seizures, and I don't really know where we can go with this right now to try and help her, and I thought maybe you could offer some advice.
Oh, sure. Who's regulating her medications right now? What sort of doctor is she going to?
She's going to see a neurologist with a vast amount of experience in Billings.
Okay. So she's seeing a neurologist in Billings, and he's at the end of his rope in terms of a decision-making? What does he say?
That's the situation, and he's because of the fact that none of the meds are really solving the problem, he's leaning towards a specialist in the realm of seizures. Mm-hmm.
But he's a neurologist. How many neurologists are in his group? Is he an independent person? Or
I'm not sure. I'd have to talk to my wife and see. I believe he's alone in his practice.
Okay. I have a very specific suggestion. So here you're going to a neurologist who is a general neurologist and deals with seizures. If you go to a larger clinic, or, you know, an academic site, they often have neurologists who deal with seizures only. That's all they do. Seizures in the morning, seizures in the evening, seizures at night, in all seriousness. In other words, that's all they deal with. And they often deal with seizures in children because it's common. And your neurologist is saying, look, I've tried everything I know of, but I want you to see someone who sees more seizures than I do.
Okay.
Because your daughter is still breaking out, and your neurologist is not sure what to do. So what you want to do is look at an academic center that is nearby. A university center would be an example, or a major medical center, a group that has a number of neurologists in them. And you want to call up and say, look, my daughter, I want to make an appointment. We're going to send our neurologist information, but my daughter has seizures. Who in your group does nothing but seizures? That's what you want. You want a seizure specialty neurologist to look at your daughter. So because you're in Montana, that's going to, you're not going to have to get in a car and go somewhere. You know, ultimately. But then that neurologist is going to communicate with your home neurologist, and you may have to do periodic visits. But sometimes with seizures, it's kind of like making a cake. It's the best example. You know, you want the best chocolate cake you can have, and sometimes you've got to fidget a bit, but somebody who really makes a lot of chocolate cakes is going to know how to make a really good one. That's what you need here. You need somebody who has more experience than your present neurologist.
And her current physician should be able to guide us in the correct, you know, to the correct locality or the correct facility.
Absolutely. This is exactly where you call up your local family doctor, pediatrician, and say, look, or you call up the neurologist and you say, I agree with you. Who do you recommend? What group is really good that we can go to? Your neurologist is going to be able to make that recommendation. You're not the first person who goes to a doctor and says, that doctor says, I want to get another opinion. I'm not doing everything well. This commonly is done. And in urban environments, it's easily done because you'll say, I want you to see your partner.
Yeah.
The problem is you're in a more rural environment, so it's a little bit tougher. But, yeah, they should tell you how to go there. Absolutely. And if you don't get any good reaction to them, you call us back. I know some people in Montana, and I can give you some recommendations.
Wonderful. Thank you much for your help.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. And Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. We have a listener myth today from a listener named Tom that deals with a relatively modern day myth about watermelons. Tom writes, Zorba, all right, I'll be the 47th person to ask this question. Any truth to the stories that watermelon is a natural equivalent to Viagra? By the way, you're not the 47th person who's asked us this. I think you're the first person.
I think it's actually the first person. I love it. I love it. So eat a half a watermelon, and that'll get you better sex.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line. It's such a fascinating thing. So, there are some people who believe that passively there's something in watermelon that might be equivalent to Viagra. I love it.
Yeah.
But if you do the research, you find that generally these are people who are in academic institutions that are somehow involved in the production of watermelons. And so there are watermelon research groups that are saying, yes, watermelon is like Viagra. And the best analogy I have for you is my father. My father believed that gum was brain food. And he would bring things from the Sugar Institute.
Yeah.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is a Sugar Institute because at that time he was in the gumball business, and he would say, gum is brain food. It's good for you. It increases your brain power.
Yeah.
And I'd say, Dad, it's gum. It's sugar. And we would have this discussion. Getting back to the watermelon.
Yeah.
No, you can eat a half a melon or a full watermelon a day, and I don't think it's going to improve your erections.
Well, you probably shouldn't say that because in this particular area, I think, Zorba, mind is a very important element.
Yes, that's it.
And
it seems to me
that placebo effect might be a very valuable tool
That's true.
So
that's
eat
true.
Plenty of...
That's true. I take that back. Eat those watermelons, and I promise you, you will have better sex.
If your myth lasts for more than 4 hours, it's time to send it to Public Radio's favorite family doc. Just send your myth to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Why don't we change the subject? A listener with us now, Zorba, in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I have been having night sweats. I have a problem with
night sweats, regardless of the season and regardless of the temperature of the house, which is pretty consistent. And I'm 43 years old. I don't think I'm going through menopause. And I really can't figure out. I've thought of some sort of different things, but I really can't figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And neither can my doctor.
So these occurred. When did they occur? How long have they been going on?
Normally occurs sort of mid sleep cycle. Mm-hmm. So, and I wake up from them usually about 3 o'clock in the morning mm-hmm. or so. Okay. But sometimes I get them during naps too. Mm-hmm. If I take a nap in the afternoon once in a while.
Now, at what age did these start?
Probably about 2 years ago, right about when I turned 40.
Mm-hmm. And you're menstruating in a normal way.
Yes.
There's nothing. And
yes.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, that's the first thing you think of
yes.
is whether or not
yes.
there's menopause. But if you're menstruating, you're not going through menopause.
Correct.
You've looked up night sweats on the web, right?
Yes.
And you've seen a ton of things that can cause night sweats, right?
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes. Everything from tuberculosis, I think, to bad
yeah.
breath in dogs has been
right.
implicated with night sweats. And what happens is that with things like this, we tend to look at the most common problems, you know, things that are infections that can actually cause night sweats, menopause, and so
okay.
on. And after that, I have to tell you, idiopathic night sweats are just common. In
okay.
other words, where you just
yeah.
run out of things, you know, they may be. And I have people in my practice that continuously complain about this. They kind of come and go. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
it's worse, sometimes it's better. And they go, what are these night sweats? And we often don't have a good answer for this.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is there. What do you do about it?
Not much. I mean, I just wake up and sometimes I get up and go to the bathroom and cool down a little bit and,
mm-hmm.
you know, wipe myself off and
mm-hmm.
then go back to bed. But
right.
a lot of times I don't really realize it until my alarm goes off in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I have rheumatoid arthritis, so mm-hmm. I've always asked my rheumatologist if this was a situation, if this uh-huh. was associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I thought it was linked to when I would flare, when
mm-hmm.
I'd have flare-ups in my rheumatoid arthritis. But I've been well controlled with just anti-inflammatories right now. I'm
mm-hmm.
not even on any disease modifying
medications. Uh-huh.
And they're worse than they've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what's going on.
What'd your rheumatologist say, by the way?
He said he doesn't know.
That's exactly right. Put it in
yeah.
the maybe realm, because as I said, if you Google
yeah.
night sweats, you'll get a list
yeah.
that are multiple
yeah.
screens long. And the answer is, even though you're not having a flare, the RA could be part of the issue. But
okay.
for the most part, I think they're idiopathic. We don't know what they're from. And so, you know, we
okay.
have to deal with it. You know, wet pillows and wet clothes in the morning, it's not fun. You know, as long as it doesn't
yeah.
wake you up, it's the real issue. And
yeah.
I think that's what it is. You know, it's disconcerting not to have an answer. But for many people, for most people, night sweats are benign. They don't mean a serious disease.
But I do wonder, because I have been on prednisone on and off for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
I wonder if my adrenal gland has gotten messed up.
Prednisone can definitely cause night sweats. There's no doubt
yeah.
about it. Steroids can
yeah.
cause it. And if you want to know whether your adrenal gland has been somehow there's an issue with this, that is a good place to look. And there's a test
okay.
called the ACTH
okay.
stimulation test that'll tell whether or not your adrenals are actually doing something. And that's an excellent idea, because this could
okay.
be related to adrenal insufficiency. Absolutely.
Okay.
I definitely would get
okay.
that checked out. Good point. You know, and there's another good point about this. The longer you talk about it and try to figure things out often, the better judgment you're going to get. So here it was. We were discussing it.
Yeah.
I said it was probably
yeah.
idiopathic. And by the end of the discussion,
right.
I think you have to get
right.
tested for adrenal insufficiency. So good
okay.
call on your part.
Well, I don't want to sound, you know, kind of diagnosing myself. But,
hey,
you know, it's sort of
it's
gets
America.
To a point where – after a long time, you just start to wonder, you know, might there be something, so.
Absolutely. Thanks for your call. Let us know what happens.
Well, terrific. Thanks so much.
Sure. And before we punch out for the week, Zorba, let's follow up on a fun discussion we were having not too long ago. You'll remember when we were debating licorice and why it's pronounced as such, and licorice is the preferred. We received a lot of fun feedback from listeners on this one, including this note from a gentleman who said our discussion brought up another one of his word pet peeves. He says, Why do we pronounce words that have an S in them with a Z sound? Words like husband. It's not spelled husband, so why do we say that?
How am I supposed to know?
No.
Well, I'm not a linguist.
Keeping up with the S. He goes on. Keeping up with the S theme.
Okay.
He also hates it when we add an extra S sound to the plural pronunciation for singular words that end in S.
Okay.
Like keeping up with the Joneses.
You know, I think a little Haldol or Thorazine would help this person very, very well. This is a question. But you know what? These are very interesting things. And a good friend of mine actually was a linguist.
Yeah.
And he had an explanation. Why do we say an husband versus a husband?
We don't. We shouldn't.
We shouldn't. And there are a whole bunch of issues in there. And usually that's because
an history lesson? Yeah, no, we don't say it. We shouldn't. That. A lot of people do, but you shouldn't do that.
But so there are all of these issues that occur. And basically what I would recommend to our listener, very, very importantly, is I would recommend a PhD in linguistics.
Yeah.
I think that would actually solve the problem. And so he could tell us precisely how to pronounce it, it would be a good
and
idea.
And as far as pronunciation and spelling are concerned, the English language, unlike every other language in the world, is awful.
Absolutely terrible. Yeah. Absolutely terrible. Two L's, one L, A, E, I, O, U. Yeah. Who knows?
Well, that wraps up our time with licorices. Send non-licorice lifestyle questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We will see you next week,
Zorba. Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Adam never sleeps. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam, Uncle Al Friedrich, and technical director Brad Big Al Kohlberg are the two laugh-in fans responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, who remembers laugh-in, I'm Tom Clark, who also does.
And Goldie Hawn.
Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0112Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.